Hello and welcome to the latest oneliner.com podcast. We are very sorry about the delays. Life has once again gotten in the way, but we're back now to give you some more truth bombs about the films we've seen.
I hate life.
Life hates you, Scott. It's a mutual feeling. The man you just heard there was Scott Morris.
Hello.
And I am Drew Tavendale. Mr. Craig Eastman, the finest of fellows, has recently had a daughter, and the fool has decided that spending time with her, or indeed catching up on some sleep, is preferable to talking shit about films with us, the utter bastard.
What a loser!
Yes, we imagine he'll come to his senses at some point in the future, but until then you've got to put up just the two of us, and without further ado, let's...
Hey, we can make it if we try. Just the two of us. You and
I. Yes, quite. Well, apparently with some further ado, let's move on to our first film, a time travel comedy, a term I tend to use loosely, a Richard Curtis film.
I think it's called a traumedy.
Yes, it's about time, Scott.
Right, yes, as you mentioned, this is a Richard Curtis film, so I'm sure you know what to expect. Tim, played by Domhnall Gleeson, received some surprising news from his dad, Bill Nighy, on his 21st birthday. The men in his family can travel backwards in time. Only the men, though. Another typical example of the patriarchy oppressing womankind.
Damn chauvinist physics.
Oof, I loathe it so much. While Tim's sure that his dad's pulling his leg at the tales of finding a dark place, thinking hard, and then magically travelling through the time screen.
That sounds like a euphemism.
Fortunately, no, it's actuality. This actually happens. A quick visit to the cupboard verifies this tallest of tales. It is, however, limited to their own lifespan, and after some plot-limiting warnings given about family members who have used their power to achieve financial gain but ultimately no happiness, Tim kind of agrees with his dad to be relatively restrained and subtle in his use of his inbuilt TARDIS. It would be wise to think no further about the mechanics of this, such as what happens to the earlier versions of Tim in the past who clearly weren't in a cupboard at the time that future Tim appears at, but you shouldn't think any further on this, because not only are such eventualities not explained, the precious few rules that Dad relates are ignored or added to whenever Curtis writes himself into a corner. So in that regard, time travel might as well be a cardboard box with a shiny red button on it that says plot device. But you didn't probably come to this film expecting it to be Looper. You expected, or will sorely be disappointed to find, a lightly comic treatise on love and relationships in much the same vein as Love Actually or Four Weddings and a Funeral or Notting Her. Chance to be a fine thing.
Promises, promises.
And relax. But that's exactly what Curtis provides. In this instance, after a few growing pains, Tim settles into a relationship with Mary, played by Rachel McAdams, using the whole time travel thing quite sparingly. It's called into use a little bit more when dealing with Tim's family, in as much as it provides a useful way to say a final goodbye to Tim's father, in a scene that's surprisingly schmaltz and sentiment-free. Just kidding, it's laid on with a trowel. It's the same in dealing with Tim's sister, Kit Kat, played by Lydia Wilson's self-destructive tendencies, although, honestly, the central time travel gimmick proves both so useless and so sparingly used that it kind of makes me wonder why they bothered including it at all. While About Time doesn't really deviate much from the standard Richard Curtis playbook, the central relationships between Gleeson and McAdams, and Gleeson and Nighy, are rather more believable and helpfully rather much funnier than Curtis's other recent rom-coms, with much better chemistry between them. While About Time contains at least 400% more schmaltzy sentiment than I like in my films, at least that's a reduction on the 1,600% schmaltzy sentimentality of, say, Love Actually. Throughout the film, there's the occasional biting line, typically from the excellent supporting Tom Hollander's acerbic playwright, and that reminds you that this is at least from the guy that once upon a time wrote Blackadder, although the net effect is to wish that you'd watched Blackadder instead. Regardless, About Time does actually have enough humour and likeable characters in it that it creeps up into being quite, well, at least mildly enjoyable, which is a massive surprise to me, and means that I have to put the vitriol cannon back into storage. It's not worth taking exceptional effort to see, and if you've seen any of Curtis's previous films from the last decade or so, then you've pretty much seen this, but it's far from the worst experience that could be visited upon you.
How about number of characters? Because it's normally about 16,000% above the number that most films can typically handle as well.
Thankfully, rather more restrained. There's like four that are of any use, rather than Love Actually, which had everyone.
Yes, I'm still slightly miffed that you, me and Craig are probably the only people in Britain who are in that film.
Yes.
I'm not going to say I'm pleasantly surprised, because I'm still not particularly interested in that, but it is quite a surprise that it's a Richard Curtis film that's not a complete train wreck.
I would not be beating down doors to get to see it, but I was taken aback by how little I detested it.
There's a ringing endorsement, if ever there was.
I think that's made for the poster quote, isn't it? We should move on from this to a film about cars what go fast and the men what done make them go fast in Rush. What about Rush then?
Yes, Rush. This is perhaps stating the obvious, but motor racing is a dangerous sport. But deaths are, fortunately, rare nowadays, particularly in the sport's technological pinnacle, Formula One. In a world where drivers can literally walk away from 180 mph crashes and where there hasn't been a racing fatality in 19 years, not since the weekend in 1994 that claimed the lives of Roland Ratzenberger and Ayrton Senna, it's easy to forget that death and serious injury were once common. It is to an earlier period of F1 that Rush takes us, to the 1970s, a decade which saw 9 drivers killed at Grand Prix meetings. Despite this, it is considered a golden period of the sport, and the legendary rivalry between Briton James Hunt and Austrian Niki Lauda provides a compelling story for the film. Having raced against each other in Formula 3, Lauda and Hunt make their own, very different way to the rarefied atmosphere of Formula 1, where they confront each other again, on and off of the racetrack. Rush follows their careers and personal lives to their entry to F1, to Lauda's horrendous crash at the Nürburgring in 1976, and to his frankly astonishing recovery from life-threatening injuries to return to the track and create one of the most dramatic season finales in F1 history. Now, while this is far from a warts and all look at the drivers, Peter Morgan's script draws the two men as rounded individuals and not the one-note opposite poles they could have become in less skilled hands. The two drivers had very different personalities. Hunt, the legendary playboy of the sport, hard drinking, hard smoking, hard shagging, driving by feel and by the seat of his pants. Lauda, the gifted technician, constantly seeking to understand and improve the machinery. Rightly, Hunt here is portrayed as something of a Lothario, but it's clear that he cares deeply about what he does, and he's just as dedicated to winning as Lauda. And though it seems like Lauda is simply cold and calculating, a machine perhaps, always weighing up risks, a wonderful scene where he impresses 2 Italian fans and his future wife with his driving in public roads puts aside that notion and proves he can be as wild as Hunt when he wants to be. As different as they were, what they shared was passion, skill, dedication and respect. And this comes through in droves in the excellent central performances of Chris Hemsworth as Hunt and Daniel Brühl as Lauda. Both have difficult jobs here. Hunt's swagger and overconfidence could be just as off-putting as Lauda's coolness and ruthlessness. But the depth of the drivers' personalities and their insecurities are revealed over time, and both actors succeed in creating compelling portrayals of brilliant but flawed humans. And, refreshingly and accurately, there are no villains here, just different types of hero. A sporting rivalry and overcoming seemingly insurmountable odds are places director Ron Howard has visited before, see particularly Cinderella Man, and while there are certain sporting biopic clichés, montages etc. here, Howard avoids one of his own clichés by not becoming schmaltzy or mawkish. Nor, fortunately, does he shy away from some gruesome images, necessary to sell the dangers inherent in F1 at the time. He's not gratuitous either. An early scene soon after Lauda and Hunt join the elite serves to remind the audience and the characters just what's at stake, and while the shot stays on screen long enough for the audience to do a double take and realise just what they're looking at, it doesn't linger. Overall, this is really high-calibre filmmaking from Howard. He's aided by some excellent cinematography from Slumdog Millionaire's Anthony Dodd Mantle and some superb stunt driving, using a mixture of replica and classic racing cars in exhilarating race scenes. And when adding Morgan's screenplay, this becomes one of the most enjoyable and most accomplished sports films I've ever seen. If there's a downside, it's the not trying to sound like Murray Walker at all, no honest race commentator who's heard throughout. While not credited as Walker, he sounds enough like him that the intent is clear, but not enough like him that it's anything other than utterly bloody infuriating.
Yeah, I believe he's credited as Murray Falker.
Yeah, that's really the only thing I didn't like about this film. I know, Scott, that you felt it ran a little long. I didn't feel that. But yeah, just that grated with me because I just wish perhaps they'd used the archive footage of Murray Walker. It's certainly for a lot of the English-speaking world, he's the sound of F1, the voice of F1. But
yeah,
I can overlook that.
I mean, or quibble. I suppose I've got a few more. Overall, I enjoyed it, especially for someone almost no interest in Formula 1. But it's a great performance, particularly from Daniel Brühl as Niki Lauda, and I like the fact that the screenplay is not afraid to make both its lead characters tools. which they quite frequently are.
They're not like villains, or they're just the wankers sometimes.
They're rightly arrogant as to best characters, as the best drivers in the world. Perhaps they have a right to be, but they at least felt like proper, believable characters and so on.
Yeah, I said they don't just feel like constructs for a film with a rivalry.
Yeah,
they feel like real people.
That was the only other thing that again really bugs me. It did feel a trifle too long. At the same time, it also doesn't handle a lot of films like this have the same kind of flaw where it can't really handle time properly. You would be quite forgiven for thinking that everything happened in one season of F1, because it seems like they just immediately join F1 at the same time and have this season where it actually looks like what, 3-4 years or something apart from certainly Lauda's first year in the sport to this season that's kind of dealt with here. And that's kind of glossed over, but that's why Wikipedia is around. You don't really care about that,
I didn't feel that so much, but then I, being a Formula One fan, kind of knew the time scale, so I wasn't thinking about that so much. I think as if you didn't know quite when they came into the sport and when they were racing, you might feel more like you're saying, Scott, with the time not passing particularly well.
It did feel to me like it was just kind of glossed over, the whole jump from like Formula 3, Formula 4,
I think.
To Formula 1 without really bothering with interstitial time. But it's a very minor thing in the grand scheme of things. Overall, it's certainly one of the best kind of sporting biopics that I've seen in a good long while. Yeah, some tremendous performances. I thought Chris Hemsworth does pretty well as James Hunt as well. So, overall, we can't fault it too badly. It's definitely worth taking a look at. If nothing else, for Clay Regazzoni's fearsome moustache.
Indeed.
And also the antics of the ridiculous posh boy Formula One Hesketh team.
Yes. I considered talking about that when I was saying about the very different routes they took to Formula One. I don't want to speak too much more about it because it's a treat. I'll leave it for people watching us. Just it's basically the Hooray Henry team, though, isn't it? Okay, now on to something very different and much darker. Prisoners, Scott.
Prisoners sees Keller Dover, played by Hugh Jackman, and Franklin Birch, played by Terrence Howard, face a nightmarish situation when their daughters go missing from their suburban neighbourhoods over Thanksgiving, I believe it was. Of course, they call in the police to investigate, headed by the infeasibly named Detective Loki, played by Jake Gyllenhaal. The only lead they have seems to be a suspicious-looking RV that was parked around at the time. This is duly tracked down, and it turns out that Alex Jones, played by Paul Dano, is in charge of the vehicle, if perhaps not fully in charge of his own mind. However, interrogation of Jones doesn't reveal anything or lead to any evidence that he was involved in the disappearance, so he is reluctantly cut loose. Keller doesn't react well to this, first losing his temper and then taking rather more direct action, refusing to believe that Jones wasn't involved and that Jones doesn't know where his daughter is. He kidnaps him, imprisons him, and sets about torturing some answers out of him, to little effect. Now, narratively speaking, there's not a great deal more to the film, although the through line of the whodunit leads to some revelations towards the final act that I shall leave unspoiled for now. But in essence, the bulk of the film is based around Keller's determination to pursue any measure to save his daughter, and the stress that this puts on him and his relationship with his friends and family, especially given the eventual revelation of what Keller's been doing with his spare time. Of course, there's also Detective Loki's angle, who's now charged with investigating both the disappearance of Keller's daughter and the mysteriously vanished Alex Jones. Now, that perhaps doesn't sound like a lot to fill up a 2.5-hour film, and indeed it does feel maybe half an hour too long. However, it's doing such a good job as a character piece that you might not notice. Jackman's performance could hardly be described as subtle, but it's effective, and I can't imagine too many people really taking issue with the rationale behind an emotive, shouty performance. However, the contrast to an excellent, underplayed and tremendously effective Paul Dano turn is pretty stark. I'm sure that's the intention, but I'm not 100% convinced that it's not a little too much of a style clash to really work. Regardless, between these pretty uniformly great sporting turns from Gyllenhaal, Howard and Maria Bello as Keller's wife, I don't think you can really question the quality of the cast. It is a very slow burn, and while it closes strongly, there's enough of a drag in the middle stretches to stop it being a properly great film. However, the fact that the closest comparison point I can come up with is the excellent and underappreciated Zodiac should, I hope, speak well of Prisoners. It can't match Zodiac for overall quality, but it's an effective and well-crafted drama, as well handled as I've seen in a pretty long time, and it's certainly worth watching at your earliest opportunity.
How does it compare to a film of just a couple of years ago, perhaps three, on the same sort of topic, The Lovely Bones? Because I was very disappointed by that. It seemed superficially, at least, that it was covering similar ground.
Well, The Lovely Bones kind of had its flaws and more, and it was just very boring, and the characters weren't particularly interesting.
No, that's absolutely correct.
That was really, I think, if memory serves, the main thing. Did that have some sort of weird supernatural tale twist at the end thing, or is that a, am I kind of misremembering that, I think?
I just remember it was voiceover done by a ghost, but I don't think it was anything supernatural about it otherwise.
That's probably it. It was just kind of voiceover by the character that kind of turned out to be dead eye. It works because it does have characters that you can more or less put yourself in their shoes of, like, what would you do in this sort of situation? What would be going through your head? And it's more interesting in that regard, in that there is at least something to get your teeth into regarding that, whereas Lovely Bones was just kind of a relatively placid and quite dull detective story, where the detective story is kind of more of the kind of framing device to eke out a few more details about the character, particularly of Paul Dano's backstory. And between Dano's performance and Gyllenhaal's performance, you can get some really good tasty stuff out of that. And okay, Hugh Jackman is sort of justifiably chewing the scenery somewhat, but it works in the context of the film. It would probably look stupid, and perhaps as part of if you just watch the trailer, he just seems to be shouting an awful lot, and that might seem annoying, but it does work in the context of the film, and you can understand where he's coming at from a character perspective. And so I think in that regard, it's one of the more interesting sort of character-based things you see. Yeah, I would say it's definitely worth putting on your watch list.
Okay, sounds good though. Some cast.
Yes.
And watch Jake Gyllenhaal and Paul Dano and more or less anything, so.
Yeah.
Them alone's enough of a draw.
Moving on. An equally well-respected cast. And well-rounded drama in...
Winning cast, Scott's a winning cast.
It wins, it can't stop winning. Yes, Machete Kills.
Yes, Machete Kills. I'm not sure if that's an accurate pronunciation, Machete, but that's how Danny Trejo does so in the film, so I shall follow his lead. Machete Kills, Robert Rodriguez's lowish budget follow-up to his surprisingly successful and surprisingly entertaining low-budget Machete, once again sees Danny Trejo as the titular knife-wielding ex-federale. The story is that of Mendez, a repentant former leader of a Mexican drugs cartel, who has gotten hold of a nuclear weapon and threatens to fire it upon the United States unless the US invades Mexico and wipes out the cartels. No, wait, it gets stupider. Machete is charged with tracking him down and disarming the missile, but when he does so, Mendez arms the device and links it to his heartbeat. Machete must now keep him alive and take him to the United States to find the one man able to disarm the heartbeat trigger. The difficulty in this is the $10 million bounty placed in Mendez's head by Mendez. No, the other Mendez. What? Oh, so sorry, right, I didn't mention that Mendez has two personalities. Right. You see what I mean about it getting stupider? Not that it's meant to be serious, of course, and stupidity in this sort of film is not necessarily an impediment. But unfortunately for Machete Kills, stupid is really all it's got going for it. And it actually starts out really promisingly from the fake trailer for Machete Kills in Space. And for the first 20 or so minutes afterwards, it's a hoot. The ludicrous over-the-top deaths and the sending up of its grindhouse roots provide plenty of laughs, but it swiftly runs out of steam, and as more plot is introduced, the frequency of laughs dips precipitously and it becomes boring. And like the first film, it revels in a huge list of cameos and larger roles from familiar faces, big stars this time around, including Mel Gibson, Antonio Banderas, Lady Gaga, and one little-known Carlos Estevez. And while these can lead to some laughs, very few of them are on their A-game, and it's just not enough to save a turgid story. Criticisms of sexism have been levelled at it, for instance because nearly all the women in Machete Kills are prostitutes or corrupt, which is valid, but it'd have to be a much better film to legitimately care. And even Danny Trejo himself doesn't fare very well here. His deadpan delivery more often than not just ends up feeling dead. It's a pity because, as I say, it starts promisingly and there's some real belly laughs early on, but when the film starts stopping the over-the-top silly action stuff and starts trying to have people spouting the worst dialogue I've heard in quite some time, it becomes untenable. And even if you enjoyed the first Machete, I couldn't recommend this. It has enough material for perhaps a 30-minute short, and ideally that's what it should have been, but it's just not good, I'm afraid. I can't recommend that.
Yeah, criticising an exploitation film for being exploitative is maybe on a hiding at nothing there. But
even if it's supposed to be a postmodern exploitative film, all-knowing and such, but I'd care more if the film was better, more entertaining, but it's not.
Yeah, can't. Not much point in labouring it. There's just not enough there. There's clearly about 20 to 30 minutes at start that's good, and maybe another 10, 15 at the end. But the middle is all filler, no killer, regardless of what the title says. Yeah, there's just not enough there. They're trying to pad it over with a convoluted plot that doesn't really bear thinking about. And I mean, seriously, Mel Gibson. It's rather puzzling how you got from the start to going to space at the end. Given that the plot, such as it is, takes up so much of the time, it's puzzling that it's just so woefully underexplained.
I don't think there's anything that you could explain, though, Scott.
No, I suppose it doesn't really do explanations, but it doesn't really do fun for a lot of that as well. No, a lot of the cameos fall flat. It's just not worth it. I mean, surprising that of all the Grindhouse films from that little experiment some time ago with Death Proof and Planet Terror and all that, it's surprising that the trailer that was in one of them turned out to be the most successful enterprise, but I think it's time to put a stop to this now. Let's not see Machete Kills in space. I think that trailer is enough.
Yeah. The fact that it got as far as it did, given that it itself started as a spoof trailer, is quite impressive, but I think they've done all they can. They've beaten this horse to death. So, on to something quite different, which is apparently about Porno Rice.
Are you talking about Blue Jasmine?
That's the bunny.
Well, it's not that at all. It will come as no surprise to you to hear that Blue Jasmine has been declared a return to form and Woody Allen's best film in years, as has every film that Woody Allen has made as long as I've been alive has been declared a return to form and Woody Allen's best film in years, even when that film turns out to be Cassandra's Dream.
Yes. I was going to mention that.
Sadly, we can't get rid of it. The Blue Jasmine in question, in this case, is played by Kate Blanchett, a New York socialite who was top of the social scene, married to Hal, played by Alec Baldwin, the go-getting businessman around town. However, turns out that Hal was basically selling pyramid schemes, and all that falls around his ears. As he's carted off to jail, Jasmine is left absolutely destitute and is forced, perhaps against her will, to move back to San Francisco to see her estranged sister, who hasn't really been keeping up relations with, but she moves in with him and tries to get herself back on her feet, while having numerous flashbacks to better times amongst the New York social scene, and kind of losing her mind in the process. She takes up a unhealthy interest in vodka, and while she tries to get herself back on her feet, her lack of a support structure and basic inability to accept the downgrade in station does not play well with her mental health. Meanwhile, her sister, Ginger, played by Sally Hawkins, has to go through her own troubles of putting up with Jasmine's mood swings, general moodiness and bitchiness towards all her friends, and still thinking of herself as being superior to the working class roots that her sister stayed with and to her working class mechanic boyfriend. You could probably make a case for it being one of Woody Allen's best dramas that he's done in a long time. However, I don't think that's saying much. The only film that I've seen of late of Woody Allen's that I thought really properly worked was Whatever Works, the more comedy-based film with Larry David, which was at least fun in a comic sense. In terms of drama, this one more or less works for what it is. It does have a very central problem in that Jasmine is the least likable lead in a film that I've seen this year, certainly, and a good candidate for just least likable lead character in anything, and regardless of the situation and how you may feel about that and how that has affected her and whether it being her fault or not, it doesn't really matter because she's really annoying. So a lot of the film is just with me grinding my teeth watching Kate Blanchett doing a good performance, but it's a good performance of someone that I don't want to see. So that did kind of hamper it a little bit. The other thing that put me off a little bit with the film is basically the same kind of thing that you would have with almost every Woody Allen drama. It's by no means specific to this, but his dialogue is never the most believable.
Mm-hmm.
It's the sort of thing that would look well written down, but when it's actually spoken, it just doesn't seem quite right. I've always had this problem with most of Woody Allen's stuff. he seems to be better at writing comedy than drama, I think. He doesn't have quite the same issues when he's writing funny stuff. But when he's going to be a bit more serious, I think he tends to go a bit wordier than most people. That really makes sense for most people to do. Perhaps because of that, or perhaps in the way he's shooting things, the way something's framed, I just never get the impression that when I'm watching a Woody Allen film, certainly his dramas, that I'm actually watching a film. It seems very much like I'm watching a recording of a play, at best. Sometimes at worst, it feels like I'm sort of standing over Woody Allen's shoulder and watching him sort of shouting at people off camera. It just never feels properly like a film. I was talking about this earlier. I can't find a particularly great way of condensing that into words, but it just doesn't feel particularly cinematic. Mm-hmm. It feels like I'm watching, at best, a sitcom or a television program that someone's put on the screen. It doesn't sit quite right with me for reasons I can't. Obviously struggling to properly get across. But you could, or at least I would, make those same comments about every Woody Allen film that I've seen in a good last few decades, maybe. As a drama, Blue Jasmine, it's interesting, but it's mainly interesting because the lead's so obnoxious, and it's kind of difficult to recommend, even if it is a very well-portrayed, obnoxious character. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily something you're going to want to watch. It is worth seeing, I think, in the final analysis. The way that the character's portrayed and the whole kind of thing with the flashbacks and the way it piecemeals out the details of Kate Blanchett's character is interestingly handled enough that it is worth seeing, even regardless of what your eventual opinions of the character would be. It's not innovative, but it's really well handled the way that it's doing the whole kind of non-linear stuff and piecing in bits of her current, by her standards, low status life and her previous socialite stuff. It creates lots of very obvious contrasts and juxtapositions that are perhaps a bit cheap, but nonetheless quite effective. Overall, Kate Blanchett's character is interesting, if not likable or particularly watchable, and that's got to be worth something. I mean, it's certainly a film that I thought about a bit more than most films that I've seen this year, so you can't go too wrong with that. Woody Allen's best film in years? No, but it's one of his better films in years, which admittedly isn't saying a lot.
Much of a challenge.
Regardless, I think it's worth seeing. I would give it a bash. Certainly, if you're used to Woody Allen's particular style of directing and his style of filmmaking, then I think this is as good a drama as he's come up with in a good long while. And so, on that basis, it's worth taking a look. In this section, I come up with a very clever linking device to bring us to Stoker. Drew?
Oh, Scott, that was beautiful. The wit and the in-depth film knowledge you used to create that link, that literary genius, sir. I'll assume you will go back and fill that in later, right? Fix in post.
A lot of Woody Allen's films are based in New York, which is famous for Central Park. Now on to the next film from director Chan-Wook Park. Stoker. Drew.
Solid, Scott.
Wah, 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 wah.
This is Stoker, which we put in as our film to catch up with for this episode on various home formats, etc. It came out in DVD start of September. The transition of lauded Asian directors to working in Hollywood is not something with a storied history, so Stoker, the English language debut of Park Chan-wook, is a film to be reasonably, I feel, approached with trepidation. After her father dies in a car crash, 18-year-old schoolgirl India is introduced to a hitherto unknown relative, her father's brother Charlie. Both she and the audience quickly assume that he's a rank wrong and a no mistake, though beyond a generally sinister and malevolent aura, there's no compelling proof of this belief. At the funeral, Charlie invites himself to stay with India and her mother, and a sense of fear, intrigue and sexual tension grips the household. As the story progresses, there are a lot of potential family secrets and histories hinted at throughout, and the viewer's mind has plenty of time for conjecture as information about the characters is slowly drip-fed, though I would contend that it's fed so slowly that the viewer may simply not care, and probably die of starvation. Not caring may also be an issue when some of the secrets are finally revealed, particularly because subsequent actions don't always make a great deal of sense. Let's set aside the plot though, because Stoker really is far more about atmosphere and tone than the plot, and it's much more successful here. There's a pervading feeling of creepiness throughout, and Uncle Charlie is darkly charismatic, as is the house where they live, even though it's brightly lit most of the time. India is mysterious, but too much so. The character has in fact been compared in many places to Wednesday Addams, which, as far as I can recall Wednesday Addams at all, is pretty fair. But then Wednesday Addams wasn't a particularly interesting character either. Still, waters run deep in all that, however, but for most of the film, there isn't much more to see than the occasional small ripple. The scenes where her developing character is revealed more fully are the most effective in the film, however, and there are some powerfully and uncomfortably erotic scenes, created with infinitely more skill, finesse, and clothing than most movies, where one imagines the screenplay to simply read, "And the actress gets naked," possibly followed by a "woo" and a high five. The difficulty I have here is whether or not I can recommend this. Compared to Park Chan-wook's most famous work, i.e. the Vengeance trilogy, this is a real letdown. The quality just doesn't compare. That said, it's a very different type of film, and it's certainly considerably more accomplished than either earlier work like JSA Joint Security Area or the very recent Thirst. While it's very slow going, it's a 99-minute film that feels over 2 hours, and boring wouldn't be an out-of-place term. There are some very powerful scenes, and the overarching mood is reasonably compelling. And in the end, I rather found I was enjoying it in spite of myself, for reasons I'm not fully capable of expressing, I'm sorry to say. But this is rather undermined by the finale, which I would sum up largely as stupid.
Machete kills stupid, or...?
Oh, more just illogical stupid rather than batshit mental stupid, or Lady Gaga and space stupid. You know? Hey, Matthew Good is the real standout film because he does a great job as evil Uncle Charlie, and Mia Wasikowska is remarkably powerful in such a restrained role, but Nicole Kidman's performance and character are lackluster, given probably 85 to 90% of the screen time is given to those three actors. That's quite a problem that she's the weak link in it. The film is absolutely loaded with imagery. It's chock full of stuff, and every scene is so very deliberately composed that it's exactly the sort of thing that you could pore over in subsequent viewings to attempt to glean all of the meaning. But to want to do so, you'd have to enjoy it in the first place. You have to enjoy it enough in the first viewing, and on balance, I simply don't think it's interesting enough.
When I watched this film, I fell asleep. And I think this was an entirely fair and accurate representation of my feelings towards it. Now, I had just driven for like 6 hours beforehand, and I was very tired, and it was 1 o'clock in the morning, but it wasn't doing a particularly great job of holding my attention. That said, I agree that it is doing a pretty good job of building up the atmosphere of the piece.
Mm-hmm.
Better than most films I've seen this year, and it is a... A return to form for Chan-wook Park and his best film in years, but mainly because Thirst and I'm a Cyborg, but that's okay, weren't particularly great. It is at least a more interesting work than either of those two films. I can't really bring myself to actually go back and watch it in an untired state, because I certainly saw more than enough of it to know that I wasn't enjoying much of it, and I think it is just far too slowly paced for me to want to go back to even look at it again.
It's nigh on glacial.
Yeah, I feel like I'm doing it a little bit of a disservice. I should go back and see it before passing, well, actually watch it in a compos mentis state before passing a judgment on it. But to be honest, there's an awful lot of films out that I would have a chance of enjoying more than I would have of watching the hour or so of Stoker that I sat through before fatigue overtook me, and I just really can't bring myself to spend that hour watching something so slowly paced and so Spartan.
Yeah. See, then Spartan's not necessarily a problem. I've seen lots of sort of quite empty films, but it doesn't do enough to grab you. I mean, even with that sort of quite menacing tone there from quite earlier on, it's still, I don't know, it feels this, like it's missing substance for a lot of it. There's just nothing to grab onto while you wait for something to happen.
If at least one of the characters had been a bit stronger, it'd be easy to get behind, but I mean, there's really nothing to Nicole Kidman's character at all. Mia Wasikowska's Wasikowska's character, she's just trying too desperately to be enigmatic to really get your teeth into, and Charlie's, well, by necessity, so kind of vaguely defined for a lot of the early running, that there really isn't anything there at all. It is all just moods and sideways glances, and it's just not enough to quite carry it, I don't think. It's certainly an interesting script from Wentworth Miller, who was not someone who I had thought of as a writer at all before then. He is, of course, the star of Prison Break and assorted other bits and bobs, but I never had him pegged as a writer at all. And as a debut screenplay, it's interesting. I'll give it that much. It's brave.
Yeah.
I'll be interested to see what we can do, pull out something maybe a bit more fleshed out in future. But yeah, I probably won't go back and finish watching Stoker, much as I like Chanwick Park's stuff. This is minor stuff.
If you had the time to watch a film and you wanted to watch Chanwick Park, why wouldn't you just watch Old Boy again instead of this?
Yeah, exactly. Or, I mean, I think probably Stoker's closest in mood to something like Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
I think it does share an awful lot of Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance is quite sort of empty and sparse, and there's not much going on there, and has the same sort of slightly enigmatic characters thing going on with that, but there's just more of a hook to actually care about the things in there.
It's like, right, okay, I'm quite intrigued about this character, and you say, well, what's going on, what's his story? Okay, but in Stoker's like, yeah, okay, he looks like a bit of an evil guy. Aye. Has anything happened yet? It's 30 minutes later.
Yeah. Yeah, so that is our recommendation. Watch Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance instead.
Having caught up on something that, alas, we were rather looking forward to towards the start of the year, back to a more recent film in cinemas with Girl Most Likely starring Kristen Wiig and from the director and writer of American Splendor, Scott.
Girl Most Likely is perhaps something of a comic mirror to Blue Jasmine. It has a number of very similar plot points. Kristen Wiig plays Imogene, who is a New York playwright, although she hasn't actually written anything in a long time, who is, again, fairly big in the New York scene. However, her fiancé ends the relationship and kicks her out of the apartment, which leaves Imogene with no support structure to fall back on. She also has to move back home, not across the country to San Francisco, but just across the river to New Jersey. But that's seen as humiliating enough for her for some reason. I don't quite know what is so bad about New Jersey, but it seems to have a terrible reputation. It's like crossing the Hudson is one of the most humiliating acts that can be done in most films for some reason. The house on the Jersey side, not seen as a status symbol. So Imogene moves backwards, back into her old home with her eccentric mother, played by Annette Bening, and her younger brother, who is special, played by Christopher Fitzgerald. However, there's a wrinkle in that she can't actually move back into her own bedroom because it's been subletted to a youngster, Lee, played by Darren Criss, who is taken a hold of her bedroom, so she is forced to sleep in a dining room. There isn't, honestly, a hell of a lot more of the film than that. There is the usual friction between Kristen Wiig and her Annette Bening, or the mother. Friction between Imogene's character and Lee, which almost inevitably turns into romance despite the gap in years, which is played up at the start, despite there not really being all that much of a gap in age as far as I can see. There's a very bizarre subplot regarding her mother's new boyfriend, Matt Dillon, who's playing a CIA agent, or so he claims, and despite quite obviously not being a CIA agent, when it gets to the end, he actually is. Which is an elaborate double bluff, if I've ever heard one. It's not really worth going into the plot of Girl Most Likely. It is basically a tale of someone having to swallow their pride, return home, and realise that, oh, family, after all, quite important. Friends, aren't they great? And money and ephemeral success is not the be-all and end-all of life, and so on and so forth. Now, it differs from Blue Jasmine, in as much as Blue Jasmine did not see fit to have such a schmaltzy sentiment towards the end and was quite happy to not give the characters happy endings. At least Girl Most Likely subverts it somewhat by going for a happy ending but arrived by one of the most left-field bizarre endings that up until that point had been a fairly reasonable rom-com with, admittedly, one strange character who you just think is delusional and lying about his occupation. And that turns out to actually... it's just weird. But it's not worth bothering about because it's just an ending that is tacked on to bring a kind of warm, gooey, happy ending to a film that is, at best, okay. There isn't anything too offensive about Girl Most Likely. Kristen Wiig's, you know, a more than capable enough comic actress that she can salvage something out of this. But like what I watched recently, Identity Thief, it's the same sort of thing. It's a very lackluster plot, a lackluster story that's sort of saved by just having a couple of pretty good performances in there that can kind of salvage it and bring more out. And Kristen Wiig and Annette Bening do great work with what they've been given. And they've not really been given an awful lot. However, it's just funny enough to be, if not something I could recommend with open heart. It's funny enough that if you did watch it, you're probably not going to feel that your time's been robbed, but it's certainly not worth making any sort of real effort to track down. Mm-hmm. But if you stumble across it and it happens to be on as you're on a flight or something like that, it is a reasonable way to pass a couple of hours, but certainly not worth making great efforts to try and track down and see. Very much by the numbers, very much something you've seen umpteen times before. Nothing particularly unusual in there that is worth tracking down. Very middle of the road. We'll round off today's proceedings with a film from the controversial pen of Reverend Welsh, at least from the original book form, Filth, adapted by the director John S. Baird. Filth sees us following James McAvoy's Bruce Robertson, a cop who is perhaps best described as corrupt. This would be a light way of putting it. He is trying to get ahead as a detective in the force, largely by means of undermining, undercutting, and blackmailing and setting his fellow officers against each other so he can get the promotion that has been dangled in front of the whole department like a big juicy carrot.
He's basically a low-rent Edinburgh cop Machiavelli.
Yes. Except he's coked up to the eyeballs, so he's not doing it quite as well as perhaps he should do. He is perhaps more criminal than most of the people he's trying to track down. The central framing device is really Bruce Robertson's character. I mean, the actual plot there is kind of hooked around an investigation into a murder that occurs at the start of the film and people's attempts to try and find out who's involved in this, and that leads to revelations later on. But I mean, honestly, it does feel like the revelations are there just to kind of tie up the film and end it. The real bulk of the film and almost everything that's actually of any interest in the film is James McAvoy's character and his ever-increasing spiral downwards from what seemed to be just, at least at the start, an extreme form of office politics that gets more and more depraved as time goes on and he takes more and more liberties with his friends, such as, well, I doubt he would actually see them as friends rather than just people to exploit, but more liberties with them and his abuse of the law and his substance abuse and everything else that's going on inside his mind that leads up to a suitably compelling ending as his character inevitably unravels under the stress of all this nonsense that he's going through while under the self-delusion that he is in total control of everything that's going on around him despite the fact that he very plainly isn't. And when that eventually unravels, it is a sight to see. Now, I mentioned earlier about protagonists that aren't particularly likeable. Now, of all the protagonists you could see, Bruce Robertson is the least likeable by design that you could probably see in a film this year.
Yes, he is. Well, it's because of the title. He is Filth. He is.
Yes.
He's a particularly objectionable human being, if you can call him such a thing.
Yeah. Now, realistic, this film is not. I would hope. This is the comic book version of police corruption. It is played for laughs as much as anything else, which is the sort of thing that intellectually I should be uncomfortable with. But when I was watching the film, unfortunately, McAvoy is so compelling and so charismatic that you kind of actually find yourself at points rooting for this bastard.
I know, it's so wrong. It messes with your head, doesn't it? It's,
yeah.
Other bits too. It's like, this should be, it's clear it's even stuff that's meant for laughs, but it's like, this should be the most objectionable thing. But when you've got this ridiculous, racist, Nazi, goose-stepping police officer in one scene, I was howling.
Yeah. This is the central conflict I have with film. When you try and think about it in rational terms, this is disgusting. It shouldn't have been made. What's the deal with it? But on the other hand, it's hilarious. So it's a solid, well, actually, no, it's a good performance from James McAvoy. I've liked him in a lot of films, and this is as strong a character as he's been given. Not a likeable one, obviously, but he knocks it out of the park. And the supporting cast is pretty much universally great, where it's from Eddie Marsden. I believe it is Eddie Marsden this time.
It's not fake Eddie Marsden, which is in the last James McAvoy film I saw was fake Eddie Marsden,
yes.
Where he played the non-corrupt cop, and was less than compelling. He's the corrupt cop with real Eddie Marsden. He's great.
Yes. Between him, looks like Martin Compson's in there as well, but particularly Jamie Bell and Imogen Poots as the token female officer who eventually is actually the one.
John Sessions is the screenwriting obsessed boss. Yeah.
Yeah. Jim Broadbent's bizarre turn in some of the moments.
Yeah, we're doing a terrible job of selling this to our listeners because they're just laughing at stuff that they remember from the film instead. Sorry about that, folks.
If you are going to talk about this film in relation to anything else, I suppose Trainspotting is the obvious parallel, not least because it's full of incomprehensible Scottish accents, but because it has the same sort of inventive playfulness in a lot of it, and while it is dealing with some pretty obnoxious subject matter, it is dealing with it in a sort of LSD-addled playground sense that is really so enthusiastic and effervescent that it's difficult not to be carried along with it. And that makes it an incredibly entertaining film, and at points absolutely hilarious. How well this travels outside of Edinburgh, I don't know. I don't even know how well this would play nationwide, let alone to an international audience, but I thought it was great. I thoroughly enjoyed it, even despite the fact that it probably shouldn't have been. But it's one of the most iconic and distinctive films of this year.
It's, I mean, the story is actually not great at all. So I've not read the book, but I think...
No, there is nothing in the film, the book either. Yeah.
I can't imagine that the book's anything like as compelling, because what works so well in the film, I love, is the visual juxtaposition that just wouldn't work in the written form.
Yeah, no, I think you're onto something. I have read this book a long time ago now, but it's the sort of the glamour, if nothing else, that this has in the kind of elven sense of bewitching you, I suppose, that the film has that can't be matched by the book. And to be honest, I've read a lot of Welsh's stuff and none of it's all that entertaining. But for some reason, when it becomes a film, it provides such a solid base work for people to kind of go off and do something like this, or Trainspotting, or even The Acid House from a while back. It works far better as a kind of visual medium than it does on page, I think.
Yeah.
So you're onto something there. As you say, the plot is basically not there. It's a framing device to watch Bruce Robinson disintegrate, but watching him disintegrate is so much fun that I'm more than happy with that.
Yeah, it's deeply entertaining. It's laughably funny at points, and bits that you feel bad about laughing at too.
Yes.
It's full of objectionable characters, but it's an absolute hoot. There's just some visual bits that stick with me, even from having seen the trailer. Eddie Marson out of his tits on drugs dancing in Hamburg. I could watch that scene forever. You know, it's just right to be an animated GIF because it's fantastic. It's hard to sell this film, I think, because if you try and tell people what it's about, it doesn't sound very nice at all. Aye, it's good. So I'm doing a terrible job here. I only saw it last night, folks, and I'm still sort of playing it over my mind and laughing my arse off about it, but I can't really communicate to you quite why it's so good. And that's one thing, Irvin Welsh too, though, he's not the most subtle guy. He's a legendary Hibs fan. So the absolute, total scum of humanity, evil, corrupt character that's at the centre of this, Bruce Robertson, is a Hearts fan. Subtle, isn't he?
Yeah, I'll just reiterate, one of the most enjoyable films I've seen this year. Probably the most enjoyable film I've seen this year, even if I do feel somewhat dirty for enjoying it.
Yes. That's quite astonishingly inappropriate. I wish I could stop laughing now.
Yes. Bad taste done properly, not like American Pie.
That's it for this episode for us. We would hope, well, it's about time, in fact, we give our apologies again and said we hope we'll be back sooner this time, although those are less frequent nowadays than they used to be in the past. And, God, maybe we'll actually have a new head by the next time we do a recording. So, yes. But yes, fucking hell. So, aye, we hope you enjoyed that, and that you'll stick around for another episode. If you have any comments, please email us at podcast@theoneliner.com, or you can follow us on Twitter @theoneliner. And until then, it's fare thee well.
Bye. That's all I got to say about that. Yeah, you knows it.